Democrats are poised to benefit from a throw the bums out sort of mentality on the eve of redistricting. And so that is a good thing. And that will continue to be in the air, water, et cetera, in 2020. Plus, recruitment remains really strong for Democrats. It was super strong in 2017 and in 2018. And all indicators are that recruitment will remain strong. People are still getting up off the sidelines and feeling the need to be engaged in this current political environment where everything is on fire all the time.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. This episode features an interview with Carolyn Fiddler, Communications Director at Daily Kos, the nation's largest liberal online political community. In addition to her role at Daily Kos, Carolyn is an expert in state politics, having worked two stints at the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee. She publishes her own newsletter about state politics. Daily Kos plays an important role in the battle of ideas that's going on out there, and it helps drive its community to support Democratic candidates and progressive causes. Daily Kos has a new related nonprofit called PRISM at ourprism.org, which seeks to amplify the voices and leadership of people who are underrepresented and underreported. I stopped by the Daily Kos DC office recently to talk to Carolyn, and it was easy to grasp the knowledge and energy that she brings to the fight. We had a good conversation, well worth your listen. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Carolyn Fiddler and Daily Kos.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Carol.
Hi there.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm all right. Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Carolyn Fiddler. I'm a communications director for Daily Kos. I'm an expert in state politics. I got my start in Virginia way back. I hate dating myself, but it was 2000. So I was a wee baby intern and been involved in state politics on some level ever since. So.
Well, 2000 is very recent history for someone like me. So you are a young person in this room. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where you grew up, your educational background, where you formed your values and your interests.
Yeah. Oh, happy to. Yeah. My mom will be happy too. I grew up at a very, very small town in rural Virginia. The name of the town is Warsaw, but Warsaw, Virginia,
not the
better known one.
Yeah.
It's in a region called the Northern Neck. It's a peninsula sandwiched between the Potomac and the Rappahannock Rivers, very close to where they dump out into the Chesapeake Bay. It's rural farming community mostly. My parents both were teachers there, and I lived there the first 18 years of my life. My parents were not very political at all. They voted religiously, but they wouldn't so much as put a bumper sticker on their car. But my mom was a bleeding heart if ever there was one. And dad was more centrist, I suppose, but we didn't really talk about politics in the house. But in terms of just general values, I definitely got them mostly from my mom. And I'm extremely okay with that.
And you went off to college?
I did. I went to undergrad at the University of Arkansas. Go Hogs.
Is that the Razorbacks?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. And I studied international relations there. They have a very strong IR program because of the Fulbright connection. But then I did that internship in Virginia politics after my sophomore year and was just hooked. So I went back, added poli sci as a major, started working for the party when I graduated, and then ended up in law school a few years later. I got my JD from William & Mary. Unfortunately, Matt Gaetz and I are both William & Mary Law, class of 07.
The congressman from Florida?
Yes. He was terrible back then, too. He's always been awful.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah. didn't really realize how awful at the time, but yes, he was pretty awful in law school as well.
It's funny. I've talked to a number of people who ran into in law school. Like, I know someone who went to school with Kellyanne Conway.
Oh, wow.
In law school. And she also testifies that it was bad then. It's just maybe you show your colors around that age.
I think so. Yeah. I think that's probably pretty fair. In your mid-20s, you start to figure out who you really are. I graduated from law school and came up to D.C. I've been working in politics and progressive organizations ever since.
What made you want to go to law school?
Well, I definitely wanted another degree. I know I wasn't done with my education after undergrad. I had no lawyers in my family. I don't think I really appreciated what I was really getting myself into. Mm-hmm. But after working, you know, in politics for a while, and then I actually did a stint in a juvenile and domestic relations district court as a deputy clerk and kind of seeing the law from all angles and how it impacts real humans in everyday life. And I was like, this is the degree I want and need. Plus, I also wasn't sure I was smart enough to go to law school. Despite my 3.987 GPA coming out of undergrad. But then I met a bunch of lawyers when I was a clerk, and I was like, wow, I'm smarter than almost all of you. If you can do law school, I can do law school. So I wasn't scared of it anymore.
It's funny how things look daunting before you do them a lot of times, and then they're quite doable if you just step into it, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I mean, not to say the law school was a cakewalk by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, you seem to have put together a career which is largely been in political communications. Mm-hmm. How did that training in law help or hurt?
That's actually a really excellent question because they do teach you to write a certain way in law school that is not really conducive to the type of communicating one needs to do as a communications professional. But I did some comms before law school, thankfully, so I had that background to begin with and didn't really have to unlearn that much once I got back out of law school. But law school was really great for teaching me how to sort of translate complicated things, especially technical things about legislation, especially, and translate that to something not only digestible, but even interesting. Because a lot of times when you're writing about state politics, you don't have, you know, someone who's done an analysis of this bill in the legislature. You're just reading it online where it's posted on the state website. You're like, oh, this is what this bill is really about. And being able to do that has been a really helpful thing.
What do you think are the characteristics of a good political communications specialist, practitioner?
A practitioner. I guess I really never thought about that specifically before, but
it should be right on the tip of your tongue.
Like, I feel like at a certain age, everyone thinks they want to do comms and thinks they can do comms, but it's not true.
What kind of person is good at it?
A kind of person who is someone who's really just sort of outgoing. A go-getter, so to speak.
It takes
a lot of proactiveness,
yeah.
In terms of your professional nature, at least, to really go after things and work with people.
Is that your natural personality, or is that something you had to learn?
It's my natural personality. Yeah. I like humans. I just do. And so talking to them is, unless it's about something really unpleasant, it's something I enjoy doing anyway. Mm-hmm. So,
what's the turning point job for you where you like realize this is what I want to do, this is a good fit for me?
Well, I think it kind of came in two stages. Because I kind of accidentally got into political communications. Mm-hmm. It was something I thought I wanted to do, but I had no idea what it really entailed when I was still in college.
I mean, I don't think people necessarily think of that as a career path when they're in high school or something.
Sure.
Right? Yeah.
I was a deputy finance director for the Virginia Democratic Party. And there was a gap between when one communications director left and the new one started, and something big happened. And they're like, oh my God, we need a press release. You write well. Do this. I'm like, okay. So I wrote my very first press release. It got picked up by media outlets. It was clever and pithy. And everyone's like, oh, you're good at this. You should do this more often, like all the time. And so eventually I became communications director. And that's when I learned the hard way that communications is a lot more than just being able to write.
Well, what is it?
It's being able to pitch stories, talk to reporters, especially when it comes to being the minority party in Virginia at the time. Back in 2002, 2003, when I was at the state party, being a Virginia Democrat was not cool. It was a difficult thing to do unless you were, you know.
Who was governor back then?
Mark Warner or Tim Kaine. I was about to say, unless you were those two, it was a hard road to hoe, for sure. And I remember in 2002, back when John Warner was still a U.S. senator from Virginia, Democrats didn't even put anyone up to run against him.
Yeah.
having to answer to that day in and day out was so fun. Aside from the stress and having to learn everything the hard way, I did actually enjoy it. And so when I had the opportunity to do it again years later with the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, I was like, this is perfect. And it was. And the rest, as they say, is history.
It is. What you were, how long at the DLCC?
I'm a DLCC recidivist, I like to say. I did two stints there. Yeah. I was there for 2 years, 2010 through 2012. Mm-hmm. And then I came back in 2015. Mm-hmm. And came to Daily Coast in early 2017, mid 2017.
So let's talk about the DLCC for a second. Why don't you describe their mission for those who don't know, and talk about your what was most important about your time there?
I worked there during two very different periods for the committee. The Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee is sort of shorthand in D.C. for it. It's the D-trip, but for state legislatures. A more complete explanation is that it's the party committee that works to get Democrats elected to state legislatures all across the country in all 50 states. Actually, 49. We don't care about Nebraska. It's unicameral and nonpartisan. So 49 states.
Probably matters who's elected there anyway, but yes.
It does, but it's complicated.
I mean, it's a good chance to throw out the word unicameral.
It's true. Yeah. It's true. It's so interesting, that state.
Only but. One camel. No.
And I starting there in 2000 was quite the education. They didn't have much of a communications program to speak of before I arrived then. So building that was satisfying, although quite a challenge. Plus, it was the election right before redistricting, which everyone knows, probably knows, for Democrats went very, very poorly in 2011.
And we're still paying a price.
Oh, yes. Every day. And a big part of that was because Democrats lost majority in so many legislative chambers election night 2010.
I think we got shellacked.
Yes. But shellacking doesn't really do it justice because of just the extent of the damage.
It really changed the direction of the country.
Dramatically.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people think about Congress and how the gerrymandering that happened in 2011 kept Democrats from winning majority in 2012 there, even though they got more votes nationwide. The more important and sort of deeper and more impactful aspect of that was the fact that Republicans were able to not just gain control of all these legislatures, they were able to gerrymander themselves into majorities in these state legislatures and pass all of these policies at the state level that impacts Americans every day. I mean, nothing was moving in the federal government. Everything was moving in these GOP-controlled legislatures.
They had ALEC and they had all kinds of templated legislation ready to move through. And they're also doing the voter suppression work,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. They were getting rid of early voting. They were making registering to vote more difficult. They implemented voter ID laws. On top of voting rights, I mean, right-to-work states started popping up again for the first time in decades. And
did they do anything good?
Republicans?
Yeah. Ooh.
Not that really comes to mind. I mean,
telling pause.
Yeah, nothing's all bad, right? I don't really believe in too many absolutes.
They removed some regulation that actually was wasteful somewhere, but
maybe. But they
I
also
can't think
like
of what it was.
But they also rolled back environmental protections everywhere.
Yeah,
they
removed a lot of important ones.
Sure.
We know that. Yeah. So, what was it like to be in this organ of the party that cares deeply about these kind of elections? What is it like to live there and vibrate to that kind of small contest across the nation?
It was very different between my first and second times there, because by the time I came back in 2015, people had really started to realize how important these elections were. Mm-hmm. And in 2010, everyone's like, what does DLCC even stand for? I'm like, oh, gosh. By 2015, I didn't have to explain it to anybody anymore, thankfully. Yeah. But it's like drinking from a fire hose every day in order to keep up with what's happening electorally, what's happening politically. And especially after Republicans came to power, they wasted no time in moving as many conservative policies as they could, as quickly as they could. Because along with all those state legislators who got elected, a lot of Republican governors also got elected in 2010. So,
what do you think of the variety of groups external to the DLCC that have sprung up to work on state legislative elections in different ways?
I admit I was skeptical at first. Mm-hmm. Just after 2016, everyone suddenly noticed that state legislative elections were important. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, that we'll see how many of these groups are still around in 2 years.
Yeah. Flippable, sister district, these sort of groups. Yeah.
And we'll see if they can figure out what's going on. The thing that a lot of these groups didn't really understand about what they were getting into at the time is that state legislative elections are run differently in every single state. There's a different set of laws that apply to elections in every state. It's not like you can get involved in congressional elections. You have one set of federal laws that applies to all of them. You've got to figure out who you can donate to, how much you can, how to get, you know, whether you can coordinate or not, to what extent in every single state. A lot of these groups got started in Virginia in 2017, which A, made them feel really good, and B, was easy because Virginia has full disclosure, no limits, and full coordination is allowed as long as you just disclose everything that you do.
And everybody that I've talked to claims credit for the same victories. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to know whether that's the activity of a group or that was like the wave was heading that way at that time because of politics. Of course, it matters the efforts people put in.
Sure. I mean, it was a lot of things. And even drilling down to some of those races, especially the more marginal ones, there were dollars that went into specific places, especially in the last few weeks that did make a difference. I think that a lot of groups can claim a lot of credit for a lot of those victories. Because even though it was, you know, all the attention was there in 2017, not as much money was there for Democrats relative to Republicans. That's actually changing a little bit this year, interestingly. But basically, in the end, my attitude was and remains that the more people who come to the playground and bring their toys, money, the better off we all are. So I'm glad all these groups are still engaged.
What did you see in summary in 2018 on the state legislative elections?
It was also a good year for Democrats. Not quite as dramatic as election night 2017 in Virginia with all those wins and so close to flipping the majority. But Democrats did win majorities in a number of chambers on election night 2018 and laid the groundwork to win majorities in a few more in 2020 for sure. Also, it's important to keep in mind that Democrats are not going to be in a position after 2020 that Republicans were in after 2010 with regard to the next round of redistricting. Democrats will be in a far better position than they were last time, period. It's still going to be a hard fight to get fair maps passed in important states.
Well, it's probably a little early to tell which way the wind is blowing in 2020. But what do you feel?
It is early on one level. On another, the math is pretty much in place in most of these states in terms of how many seats are needed to flip Pennsylvania and Texas and Minnesota Senate and things like that. But it is going to be hard to know which way the wind is blowing until we get closer, because Election Day 2020 is about 12 Trump years from now. Time moves differently these days, it feels like. And anything can happen with, you know, impeachment and...
Most of the time when an incumbent president faces re-election in a good economy, they actually pick up seats. The party picks up seats.
Yes.
I think if you would talk to political scientists who make models based on those sort of variables, even despite the craziness of our politics, you might expect that to still hold mostly. What do you think the other things in the air that might affect kind of the wave and its direction?
I think other things in the air, I mean, Trump is the cloud that does hang over everything and will continue to do so.
Right. He makes a muddy wave.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, he does. But the thing that played more strongly in 2018 than I expected it to, and in 2017 in Virginia, were local issues, what's happening in each of these states. And Republicans have been in charge in most of these states for the better part of the decade. And they've had a chance to do what they're going to do. And in most cases, their states are not better off. In many cases, their states are measurably worse off. Democrats are poised to benefit from a throw the bums out sort of mentality on the eve of redistricting. And so that is a good thing. And that will continue to be in the air, water, et cetera, in 2020. Plus, recruitment remains really strong for Democrats. It was super strong in 2017 and in 2018. And all indicators are that recruitment will remain strong. People are still getting up off the sidelines and feeling the need to be engaged in this current political environment where everything is on fire all the time.
Is recruitment strong for Republicans as well?
No, not nearly as strong. Virginia is like the easiest sort of example right now because these elections are coming up immediately and Republicans just failed epically at their recruitment. They did okay in the House, but They struggled mightily in the Senate and in both chambers. So many Democratic seats are just going uncontested.
Well, how do you explain that?
Republicans are not energized to get involved in politics. They feel, I think a lot of them are embarrassed or dispirited by what's happening federally. They don't feel that level of motivation that Democrats do at the moment.
Well, and that's one of the interesting things about good elections for one party or the other is that recruitment, which happens 2 years before or a year before, plays out later on, right? It's a big part of the game. It doesn't always mean that good recruiting leads to good wins.
Oh, no, I wish. But right. No, that is...
Sometimes you recruit a good class and then the wind blows the other way and right. They all lose and mm-hmm. It's miserable.
Correlation is not causation, no, but it's much easier to flip those seats if you have a massive crop of great candidates.
Why did you leave the DLCC and why did you go to Daily Coast?
I enjoyed my time at DLCC. I accomplished a lot there, but I was really eager to move on to a new opportunity. And Daily Coast was wanting to get more engaged in state elections and really be involved in these races for 2020 in advance of the next round of redistricting. And it was just such an amazing chance to expand myself into a new direction.
For me, Daily Coast is this blog that was formed in the first half of the 2000s, mm-hmm. I assume.
Yeah.
That's when it came to my attention and kind of became a locus of liberal thought, progressive thought, democratic thought at the time. What is it now? What has it turned into?
It's the largest progressive online community in the country. And by that, I mean, it's not just like where people go to share their progressive thoughts. We raise money for candidates. We have an incredibly active and engaged email list that helps with that raising of money, but also gets people to participate in actions and petitions and helping and encouraging elected officials and corporations to do the right thing around certain issues. It's a place where you can go to not just get the news, but also do something about it. That's really exciting. And also another thing I got the opportunity to do at Daily Coast was finally get paid for this thing that I've been doing for free for, I guess, about 7 years when I came
what,
on board.
What are you referring to?
My mostly weekly newsletter, This Week in State House Action. Mm-hmm. I started writing it after I left DLCC the first time because it took them a while to replace me after I left. And reporters were coming to me. They're like, we have no idea what's happening anymore. You're not foisting this on us on a weekly basis. I'm like, oh.
Why did you start that?
Because there was a need for it. Mm-hmm. And I was still following all of this stuff anyway. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. And I felt it was very important that reporters still remain up to speed on what was happening in all these states all the time. And then I realized once I no longer had to speak for DLCC, so I could just kind of say what I wanted. So I started having fun with it. It's filled with lots of bad jokes, and it's just been a real labor of love for me for now the last 7 years. And so now I publish it under the aegis of Daily Coast, and
that's pretty cool. When
it's,
I mean, it's pretty rare to have your personal publication picked up by something with this kind of reach.
Yes, it's super super exciting.
When you started it, mm-hmm. like, give me a sense of the readership and its growth over time.
It was mostly just a press list that I had built, reporters I knew to be at least sort of interested in this stuff. I wasn't going to just spam a bunch of reporters.
So hundreds of people?
Yes. The list probably started around 150 or so. And these reporters get like hundreds of emails every day. So it was very important to me to give them something that they, you know, didn't hate to read, like something that at least, even if they didn't get anything that they could write about out of it, at least they like read it and were like, ha. That was a good part of my day.
It covered policy matters, things, or was it also like gossip around the state?
I try to stay away from the gossip, yeah. But it was policy and politics. And, you know, depending on the point in the cycle, also electoral news and things like that and analysis. And it grew over time. People would be like, hey, put me on your list. So it's all been opt-ins ever since the beginning. And then by the time I came to Daily Coast, it was about 400 or so. And now it's about 4,000. It's all still like, we didn't just put people on the list. People opted in, bless their hearts for some reason.
and of those 4,000, how many would you say are reporters and how many are just people really interested in the area?
Oh, that's a good question. I haven't really taken a real survey since. I would say that maybe 1,000 are reporters. Like, mm-hmm. The majority is just people who decided to, you know, subject themselves to my bad jokes.
In the most recent episode issue of this. what were some things that you covered?
North Carolina, what's been happening there around the budget veto and the redistricting since the last court decision that struck down many of their districts in the state house and state senate, and the process around getting those redrawn and maybe redrawn fairly, but probably not because Republicans are still in charge of the process, and happenings in Virginia. That's where most of the action is right now. Not too many legislatures are actually in session at the moment. So in terms of policy, there's not a lot moving, but in terms of politics and electoral news in Virginia, there's plenty.
Do people now write you, hey, this is happening in this state, you should cover it?
They do.
Must be very gratifying.
It is, and often very helpful. Like I work hard to keep abreast of everything that's going on everywhere, but it's still like drinking from a fire hose. So,
what are your main sources besides that kind of tip? Sources of information about what's going on?
There are a few newsletters out there that I subscribe to that kind of give that hit certain states and certain areas that I'm interested in. And mostly Google alerts, honestly. When you have Google alerts for state legislator and state senator and state representative, you get a lot of Google.
Do you cover the scandals where Republican legislator from Ohio who's been passing anti-gay legislation turns out to be gay?
It seems
to happen about every few weeks.
It does seem to be not infrequent. And even like, you know, if Democrats do something terrible too, I'll cover that. It's not my fault a Democrat needs to go.
Yeah. If you had to identify a state whose politics you find most interesting, which state would that be?
My bias is Virginia, for sure. But
Let's say outside of Virginia.
Outside
of where you went to law school and did your first campaign.
Right.
Yeah.
North Carolina is always interesting because the Republicans there have zero shame.
Yeah.
So that's always fascinating.
They focus on bathrooms and things like
that. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And they, you know, just ignore court rulings and things like that as long as they possibly feel like that they can.
Was it North or South Carolina where the Democrats were out and they passed something?
That was North Carolina.
Yeah, that was North Carolina too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They just don't care.
That seemed incredibly stupid given that it was only one of the two houses and wasn't going to.
Well, the margin in the state Senate is so small. Only one Democrat needs to flip sides for them to override that veto there.
So it may happen.
The House was the bigger hurdle for them. So.
Yeah. It feels like those tricks ought to be punished in politics.
Yeah. Yeah, but when you do it in an odd year and your elections are in even years, people have short memories, especially in the age of Trump.
Yeah.
But Wisconsin's always interesting. And Maine, as the chamber kind of gets closer and now there's a Democratic governor, that's super interesting. Mm-hmm. New Hampshire is always, there's always something happening in New Hampshire. You have a 400-member House. And
have you thought about running for state legislature yourself?
Oh gosh, no.
Why not?
Because running for office is hard.
So is being a reporter.
It's a largely thankless task.
Yeah.
You know, in the area I live in, there's no shortage of good Democrats to run for the House anyway. Maybe if I went back to my hometown, maybe I would consider it.
So how big is Daily Coast now in terms of employees?
Oh, gosh. We have north of 80 now. It's a growing organization. Mm-hmm. And
is the founder, Marcos, still involved?
Oh, yes. Very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so.
What have you learned about him?
He's actually a huge introvert.
Like, does he hole up?
I mean, he's very good about sort of resisting the urge and like putting himself out there and being out in public and being on TV, but it is sort of contrary to his nature, and I always appreciate that.
Does he work in this office where I'm?
No, he's based out in Oakland. He comes out to DC not infrequently, but he is based in the
and
Oakland
home office. Is Daily Coast, where is it mostly staffed? Where
most of the staff is scattered all across the country. We have staffers in not every state.
Very virtual.
Yes, yeah. Very virtual. But we do have an office in Oakland with a good chunk of staffers, and our second office was founded out here just last summer, actually.
How much of the content on the site is done by paid people versus people who are volunteers, essentially, commenters and independent writers and so on?
Well, in terms of like what you see on the front page, like when you go to the main page and you see the stories just like listed one after the other, that's almost all paid staffers. On the weekends, a lot of our contributing editors will submit longer form pieces, but our contributing editors also like get paid for that work. But we do have obviously a massive community of writers who just go and write whatever they want, basically. And within reason, we are very good about policing like conspiracy theories and trolls and things like that. Like we keep Daily Coast a positive community.
When you think about the competition for Daily Coast, other progressive news sites. You said you're the biggest. Mm-hmm. Who else do you admire out there and who do you like keep an eye on?
I feel like it's a very sort of symbiotic space. We don't kind of see other progressive organizations as competitors. We see, I mean, we're all kind of...
Well, you're trying to draw eyeballs to your own site.
Well, we're you know, unabashedly like a progressive democratic organization. Like, we're not making any bones about that.
Yeah. So you're not in the category of like a Post or a Times, right? No. You're in the category of who else?
Some have called us the Breitbart of the left, which is garbage because we actually care about facts.
Yeah.
Breitbart does not. So
that would be a real slur.
It would be. Yeah. And no, when people call us that, I call them up and take issue with it because Breitbart lies. We do not.
Yeah.
When someone posts a conspiracy theory, even just a community member on our site, we flag it, we take it down.
Why do you think you have that ethic and they don't?
Because facts have a decidedly liberal bias.
Do they really?
I don't know. at some point, Republicans decided that they did. When the reality of politics and policy in this country started sort of trending away from them, they decided to create their own bubble to live in and do their news in.
There seem to be areas where that's true, like climate, mm-hmm. right? Where I think for reasons of Coke or, you know, whatever, people in the corporate world that didn't benefit from climate activism picked a side and actually perverted science. But there are other areas where I doubt it. It's so clear that facts are biased one way or the other.
Well, sure. I think that I feel like when progressives see a problem, something that they take issue with, mm-hmm. they are more inclined to want to fix it, to make things better.
And or to use government to fix it. To make things better.
Just to fix it. Government's certainly not the answer to everything. Government is, you know, largely responsible for lots of the systemic racism we have in the country. And so there have got to be other ways at fixing that. But I feel like Republicans see problems and challenges, and instead of trying to tackle them, they try and change the reality around them. I don't know.
I think we're in a dark period with respect to that.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. I don't remember it being this bad. I mean, when my first job in D.C. was at Media Matters, so dealing with a lot of conservative misinformation in the media. And it was bad. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, conservatives lost their mind when a black man got elected president. But it wasn't this bad.
Do you locate misinformation on the left also? Not on Daily Coast.
No, I mean, it's like I said, on the site, we take care of it. We don't have
but we
any
have
time
our, we,
or attention
but we
for
have
that.
Our site has its conspiracy theorists and its dunderheads.
I mean... Sure, but not they don't have the kind of audience that the right wingers do. Those folks get paid to do it for some reason.
Yeah,
mystifies me.
So, what is your job at Daily Coast?
I'm communications director. Not only do I cover state politics, I help with our state legislative endorsements, which is time consuming but always very satisfying and fun. We've endorsed 11 candidates in Virginia this cycle for the House and Senate.
What does that translate to? Would you say
that translates to cash money?
Yeah.
Our endorsements aren't just press releases. Our mm-hmm. endorsements come with links to a candidate's ACT Blue page. So we encourage our community members to learn about the candidates, and if they see fit to do so, donate directly to their accounts.
And so how many eyeballs are seeing your list of 11, would you say?
Last time I checked, I think we had maybe 100,000 donors for like all of our folks combined. It's a lot of eyeballs.
That must be very fun. To be able to have impact like that.
Yes.
To like, it's not like 100 people are reading my newsletter anymore. It's like I'm directing money to candidates that I want to win.
Yes.
Yes.
And in these, especially in these state legislative races.
It's almost like you're still a party operative.
Yeah, but I've got a lot of more freedom in this role than I would at a party committee for sure.
What are the constraints on your freedom?
Daily Coast is actually a workplace that certainly appreciates and cultivates innovation and new ideas. So I would say that pretty much everything that I've wanted to do, if we've been able to afford it, I've been able to to make it happen. So
is Daily Coast a growing, profitable enterprise?
Oh,
is
yes.
it a good business?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Our revenue model is not advertising based. We were able to avoid a lot of the...
What is your revenue model?
A lot of it's just direct donations. People just choose to support the work that we do. Some of it is based around what we call lead generation, which is other organizations or even elected officials contract with us to have us email our list and ask our list members to sign up or engage with this candidate or this organization.
How do you decide who can and cannot take advantage of that?
Oh, we're pretty agnostic. I mean, if you're a progressive organization or a progressive
candidate, you have to be a progressive organization.
Yeah, we're not going to let Ted Cruz like try and fundraise from our list, which wouldn't make any sense anyway. But
it doesn't seem that aligned. No. But probably not Procter & Gamble either.
I don't know that they've ever tried, but I don't think that fits within our policies around that.
Yeah. Are you involved in the business side of things or more?
Not directly. In terms of like, it's my responsibility to help curate the brand and image of Daily Coast. I am to that, in that extent.
Do you try to get Daily Coast covered in newspapers and TV? And
oh, sure.
Yeah?
Sure. I try and get our writers and our founder on TV when we're able to sort of break a story. Like one recent example is one of our writers noticed that the LGBT forum, the presidential forum, the moderator was much more harsh with Kamala around a certain issue than she was with Elizabeth Warren. It sort of pretty clearly reeked of some racial bias there, and she pointed it out, and the Advocate picked that up. Because
bias for sure, or maybe just preferring one candidate.
Maybe just preferring one candidate, but it smelled pretty bad.
Ew.
Yeah.
That's not what you want to see. What do you like most about being here?
My coworkers are amazing. The work environment is fantastic. Daily Coast very much walks the walk in terms of being a progressive workplace.
Are you hiring?
Yes, actually.
What kind of jobs?
We are working right now to hire a new writer, and a lot of our recent hires and current open positions are actually in our tech shop. Almost all of our tech is done in-house. Mm. So,
how do you place Daily Coast in sort of the progressive ecosystem? Where does it fit?
It's a really important part of it in terms of the number of candidates and organizations that work with us to help build their own email lists and fundraising bases, in terms of us being a thought leader and a hub, a meeting point for progressives online. We're a pretty significant chunk of it. I mean, we've been running these online straw polls since January or February, presidential straw polls. It's not scientific, obviously. It's just...
Is that essentially your audience or the most?
Yes.
And I have not tracked those. Who's running ahead in that?
Warren has won the past several. We do them about every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And Warren she did really well close to the beginning, and then she dipped and she started finishing first for the past several. But the kind of interesting thing there is that she and Bernie together combined have had about the same vote share in every poll almost since the beginning. So it kind of...
She's picking up at his expense.
Right.
Which just seems to be happening generally.
Exactly.
Yeah. There may be a cap on their percentage.
Possibly.
It's hard to tell.
The most engaged online progressive activists have made their desires in terms of the presidential primary known in that way, really consistently.
Will you, as an organization, lean in the primary in support of?
We're not going to endorse anybody in the primary.
No.
So
have you in the past?
We did not last time. I don't know if we have previously.
Do you yourself have a horse?
I have a few horses.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm...
Who do you like?
I like a lot of them, frankly. I think Bernie was very important last time around. He changed the conversation. He brought a lot of progressive ideas that were not mainstream at the time, and now they're mainstream parts of the Democratic platform. And I think that was great. I don't think he's bringing anything new this time around. So I'm kind of...
He always says the same thing.
Right.
For better or worse.
Right.
For his whole career.
I feel like he's not bringing anything new this time. So he's not one of my horses. But Castro was actually really impressed me, much to my surprise. I wasn't expecting to be impressed by him at all. I'm surprised Booker's not doing better. I like Warren. I like Harris. Biden is more and more problematic. But
what do you think of Buttigieg?
He has also really impressed me. And his sort of staying power has impressed me. Like he's never finished first in our straw poll, but he's performed pretty consistently in the top like five-ish, like pretty much since he got in. He had like a viral moment and he had a surge, but he hasn't faded away the way that a lot of other candidates did. Even darlings Inslee, who obviously was much beloved of the folks who were really engaged in climate change issues, but even among our community, I don't think he ever got more than like 1 or 2% in that straw poll, which tells you a lot about not whether or not people care about that issue, which they certainly do in the Daily Coast community, but in terms of how people viewed his candidacy in a pragmatic way.
Where do you want to take your career from this point forward?
Oh, I want to stay engaged in state politics. It's my first and greatest love, professionally and to an extent personally. So
it's an obsession.
A little bit. Every Wednesday night, I would stay after work just to do my newsletter. Mm-hmm. And my then boyfriend would be like, why won't you come out to happy hour on Wednesdays with my friends and me? And I'm like, I'm working. You're not working. But I'm like, but this is important to me.
You know, one of the secrets to a good life is having a project like that, having something that you're building that just makes you happy to be immersed in it.
And it's so important.
Like, it is. What happens and you've picked something that is of consequence to the country, right?
Yeah. I mean, what these state legislators do affects just everyone. If you care about any issue, state legislatures impact it, whether it's education, infrastructure, voting rights.
And mostly we don't pay attention to it, unfortunately.
Yeah. And so I've made it my mission to bang the drum until someone does.
Do you think there's a version of that newsletter that is more popular, that is aimed at not 4,000 people, but 4 million people?
I haven't really thought of it that way. I'm not sure what would make it scalable. Maybe fewer jokes.
If you were advising a regular citizen, not a reporter covering state houses, mm-hmm. where would they go to find best information about their state legislature or what's happening across the country?
I guess in terms of making it scalable, I would want to make it sort of more consequential to more people. And that would probably involve sort of segmenting my list by region or state. So people could like, okay, this is what's happening in your state. Here's something you can do about it. I would probably add some sort of action item to get people really engaged.
That's something that you might contemplate doing.
Yeah, now that you've mentioned it.
Do you think the Daily Coast would support innovations in the state legislative reporting area?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Like any other organization, it certainly has to operate within, you know, the bandwidth it's capable of, but they are always open to new ideas.
I had heard that Daily Coast had spawned some other associated enterprises.
Yes.
What's going on in that regard?
Well, Daily Coast has an affiliated C3 organization now called PRISM.
Yeah.
It aims to elevate mostly marginalized voices in the media, people of color and other communities that don't get a lot of coverage, and their writers are not very well represented in journalism, frankly. Daily Coast also has an affiliated polling outfit called Civics that does a daily tracking poll.
Is that with a Q?
Yes.
Yes.
C-I-V-I-Q-S.
Yes.
They do daily online tracking polls of Trump approval, Pelosi approval, impeachment attitudes, gun safety, marijuana legalization, and you can go to civics.com and check out the way attitudes have shifted across all these issues over months and years.
Do they work with a pollster, or are they wholly internally
Wholly
staffed?
Internally. They have their own models and their own data, and they do it all themselves, and it's really quite remarkable.
How's PRISM doing?
PRISM's doing well. It's nascent. It just got off the ground this past summer, but it's already publishing really, really amazing stuff.
Is that on a different site?
Yes, Our PRISM.
Our PRISM?
OurPRISM.org.
And who would be interested in reading Our PRISM?
I think everyone should be interested, but especially people looking for like a different perspective on important issues like voting rights and LGBTQ issues. These writers bring a voice that needs more oxygen.
How many people work there now?
Oh, their staff is still growing. It's fairly small. They have a handful of fellows and I want to say maybe 10 full-time staffers in terms of...
Does it also use the model of volunteer writers or commenters, or is it open platform like Coast?
It's not quite open platform like the way that Daily Coast is. A lot of their stuff gets cross-posted on Daily Coast and comments are open and all that, but the writers are fellows who sign on and do often write for free or sort of pay, like a contributing editor might be paid or receive an honorarium depending on like what category they fall into, but they also have full-time writers.
What occasioned starting that?
Just a desire to grow the organization in terms of what can Daily Coast be doing that it's not doing? And that's, you know, Daily Coast is an LLC. a lot of folks were like, why don't you have a C3? And Mark was like, well, that doesn't really make sense for us. And then he started thinking, he's like, what would make sense for a C3 for us? And he put in a lot of work and research around it. And this is what happened. And it's, I think it's an amazing project.
Do you drive traffic to it from Daily Coast?
Yes, that's kind of the purpose of the cross-posting, to get some more attention and more clicks to that site.
Is there a question that I failed to ask that I should have?
You've run the gamut. We've done everything from my hometown to what do I want to do with my newsletter when I grow up. So,
well, I try to be comprehensive.
I'm pretty impressed. You've pretty much done everything but ask me about my dad's cows' names. So, like, I think we're good.
Does your dad name his cows?
He does.
What is your favorite of your dad's cows?
Oh gosh,
name?
I think that's got to be. Maybe the original. Her name was Shine, the one he accidentally bought at an auction and kind of kicked this whole brown Swiss breeding thing off. So,
well, when I was a kid, we had two cows for a summer named July and September.
Oh, I love it.
Yes. I think that's true. Unless those were the two calves, but I think those were the names of the cows. Someone can fact check me on that. It's been an honor talking to you today.
It's been a delight. Thanks for having me.
Anything else you want to say?
More people should subscribe to this podcast for sure.
Thank you. All right, take care.
The Daily Coast community is one of the key locations of progressive thought online. It's worth your visit. They're at dailycoast.com. Check out our Prism as well. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. And by the way, if you're a listener, I'm always interested in feedback. Please email me at nperlman@gmail.com.